This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. The unleashed power of the atom has changed everything save our modes of thinking. Albert Einstein said that, and don't worry, I'm not about to disagree with anything uttered by possibly the smartest man who ever lived. But modes of thinking about the power of the atom related to nuclear weapons did, to some extent, change the thinking of people at the highest levels of government around the world. Specifically, it made them change the way they thought about a world under fire from nuclear weapons and how to preserve the people and institutions in control of that world. From secret bunkers to elaborate evacuation plans and a pecking order for who gets protected and why, the U.S. government has been scheming about what to do in the event of a major nuclear attack ever since the first mushroom cloud billowed out over the New Mexico desert in 1945. That successful test of the most powerful weapon the world had ever seen ushered in a new era of global confrontation and paranoia that is of no less concern today than it was then. But the contours and the ramifications of that pivotal moment have changed over time, and they're tracked in the new book, Raven Rock, by my guest Garrett Graff, a Vermont-based journalist and historian who joins me now in our VPR studios. Garrett Graff, welcome to Vermont Edition.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
I want to point out, too, that Garrett Graff is a member of the VPR Board of Directors. Just want to make that quick disclosure there. Now, let me start with the subtitle to your book here. It's called Raven Rock, The Story of the U.S. Government's Secret Plan to Save Itself While the Rest of Us Die. Now, that is both terrifying and kind of hilarious in like a nervous laughter, are you serious kind of way. Is it hyperbole, or are we, the people, really not invited to the party that would save the U.S. government in the event of a nuclear attack?
So this is one of the major arcs of this book, beginning, as you said, after the end of World War II and coming up to the present day, is that during the early years of the atomic age, the government really did hope and try to save the American population writ large. And the idea was these very extensive government plans to push and encourage home fallout shelters and fallout shelters in government buildings like schools or office buildings. Certainly, listeners of a certain generation will remember the Bert the Turtle duck and cover drills of elementary school and the big yellow and brown fallout shelter signs on public buildings. But over time, as nuclear weapons got more powerful, as nuclear arsenals expanded beyond any reasonable size, and certainly as technology advanced from bombers to missiles and reduced that warning time from about 8 hours with a plane to about 30 minutes with a nuclear missile, effectively protecting the population became logistically impossible, both cost prohibitive and time impossible. And so you ended up with this very strange set of plans that saw the U.S. government, the highest ranks of the U.S. government, whisked away by helicopter to the mountain bunkers around Washington and scattered across the rest of the country. And the rest of us would be left more or less on our own. And that's still, to a certain extent, the level of planning that goes into these plans today. Recently, you saw the first Homeland Security Secretary, Tom Ridge, remind Americans to get plastic wrap and duct tape to protect their homes from terrorism. And that's that duct tape philosophy still very much undergirds the government's approach to the civilian population.
Yeah, and you talk, too, in the book about the little details of things that would try to be saved. Moving the Liberty Bell was one of them. Putting priority over the Declaration of Independence before saving the U.S. Constitution. I mean, this stuff has been really well thought out to an astonishing amount of detail.
Indeed, and that's sort of part of what I found so fascinating about these plans. Most broadly, they're known as continuity of government, which is the series of secret plans to ensure the transition of U.S. command and U.S. Leadership through and after a nuclear attack or catastrophic event in Washington. But as you begin to think about this, how to save America, it very quickly becomes a very existential question of if you are trying to save America, if you want to restart America, well, what does America mean? Are you talking about the Liberty Bell? Are you talking about the Constitution? Are you talking about the president? Are you talking about three branches of government? And planners over the course of the Cold War and even to the present day have really wrestled with these questions to try to figure out if America needs to restart, if the unthinkable happens to Washington or the nation at writ large. What does that mean for the future, and how do you get America back to where it was?
And you talk, too, about early in the book how, you know, up until World War II, really, it was such a different world. I mean, tourists could walk right up to and visit the White House. How did this all start to change with the death of FDR and Harry Truman replacing him as president?
So Harry Truman came in, obviously, just a few months after stepping into the vice presidency. And as you say, Washington was a very, very different place. The nation was a very different place. Harry Truman, when he took over as vice president, didn't even receive Secret Service protection. You know, the vice president of the United States just walked freely around Washington. And part of what drew me to this story in its entirety is it's the story of how nuclear weapons reshaped the presidency. I've always been fascinated and have spent a lot of my career writing about how technology reshapes institutions. And this is one very specific technology reshaping one very specific institution. And we forget until you see a selfie from Mar-a-Lago with a smiling guest and the military aide carrying the nuclear football that, in fact, much of what we think of as the imperial, majestic modern presidency is effectively a really elaborate system to ensure that the president of the United States, wherever he is in the world at any given moment, can access and launch our nuclear weapons at any time.
You know, talking about the way that the technology is reshaping things, it occurs to me, too, that you mentioned Mar-a-Lago. We've already mentioned Harry Truman. Each president brings his or her own perspective to these things. Certainly, when you look at the Eisenhower years, he was really unnerved by this amazing power of nuclear technology. And this is a guy who oversaw the Normandy invasion, you know, and so, you know, hundreds of thousands of people dying during World War II, not shaken by much, but definitely shaken by the power of the nuclear weapon. In fact, there's a quote in the book, I think you use it a couple of times. He says, if a nuclear war happens, there wouldn't be enough bulldozers around to clean up all the bodies or something to that effect. How did Eisenhower view this amazing new technology as it became apparent?
Eisenhower, you know, was president from 1953 to early 1961, and that was really the period where the atomic age comes into its own, where nuclear weapons start out during his presidency in scarcity. You know, that we don't have great delivery mechanisms. We don't have very many of them. And in fact, during that period between when he wins the inauguration and he takes office, he is told for the first time that we have tested successfully a thermonuclear bomb, a hydrogen bomb, vastly more powerful than the atomic bombs that had existed up until that point. And I think part of what makes this particular story about the rise of the national security state so interesting to me is the extent to which thinking through how catastrophic nuclear war would be and how hard it would be to protect the nation's leadership, to protect the civilian population, to protect our institutions – helps reshape the way that the presidents and Pentagon leaders really thought about nuclear war. And in president after president, and I sort of tell these stories through the course of the book, I mean, from Eisenhower right through Ronald Reagan, they have these deeply depressing and traumatic moments as they go through these nuclear war exercises, realize just how deadly and destructive nuclear war would be, and are really changed thereafter. And it helped shape their decision-making during some key moments where they chose to step back from the precipice rather than to leap forward and push forward into war.
We got this email from Mark Garrett, who says, I grew up about 15 miles from the old Griffiths Air Force Base in Rome, New York, where the B-52s of the 416th Bombardment Group were based. I can recall one American history class in high school. The teacher told us during the Cold War, there was a high probability of our area being a direct target of Soviet nuclear weapons to wipe out the air base. Do you know whether this was also the case with the Plattsburgh-Burlington-Lake Champlain area due to the Plattsburgh Air Force Base?
It absolutely was. And one of the funny things about the Plattsburgh area was it was one of the early test cases during the Carter and the Reagan years about what they called the Crisis Relocation Plans, the CRPs, which they built for urban areas or likely target areas about how to evacuate in the event of a nuclear attack or a nuclear threat. And it's this sort of fascinatingly strange moment in U.S. history, which we sort of only came to really fully understand in recent years as more of these records were declassified, where you had the U.S. government come in to rural regions like Vermont and map out building by building in towns how urban populations could be relocated to them. Huh. So I talk about, for instance, in the book, the plans to relocate one town in Connecticut to the campus of Middlebury College and the building by building breakdown of how many Connecticut residents would be housed in the field house, would be housed in the chapel, would be housed in the library. But then, of course, you end up with sort of the problems with when government bureaucrats in Washington begin to try to plan out carefully nuclear war. So I tell the story of a church in Barrington, New Hampshire, that sort of went outside. They got this notice that their church had been designated as a relocation point for a different town in Connecticut. Connecticut was going to flee north into Vermont, New Hampshire. And they sort of looked at their church and the roof rising 40 feet off the ground and wondered how exactly they were expected to bury their church in a foot of dirt as the government demanded during a nuclear attack. And, of course, what happens if a nuclear war happens during the 6 months of the year when the ground is frozen?
Not to mention the bake sales and everything else that are going to be, you know, have to change their plans a little bit. Yeah, not always the most well thought out things. I want to get back to the Eisenhower years briefly because I found this fascinating in your book, too. The interstate highway system that he is so famous for funding and for constructing, it wasn't just about making it easier to travel by car to visit grandma on Thanksgiving. How did Eisenhower's time spent in Germany during World War II inspire in large part the modern system of highways we kind of take for granted today?
So I definitely want to answer your question about the highways, and then there's a second set of highways that are equally interesting to talk about that helped shape this. So Eisenhower, actually, when he was a young Army officer, was part of the first transcontinental convoy in the United States and spent the better part of a year driving across the United States in the first Army convoy to go coast to coast in motorized vehicles. It was a disaster. There were no roads for much of that stretch. You know, they were caught in dust, mired in mud. It was just a debacle. And then when he got to Germany and he got to Europe during World War II, he was fascinated at the road system that Adolf Hitler had built to speed war material around the country.
Is this the Autobahn?
Autobahn and sort of all of that road network. And he came back to the United States convinced that we needed some sort of similar system for military purposes. And so part of his argument for building the interstate highway system is the idea that we needed to be able to more speedily evacuate urban areas and we needed to be able to more speedily move war material around the country. And so the original plan for the interstate highway system, it's actually called the Interstate and Defense Highway System. Hmm. Now, the roadway is one set of systems here, but part of what is so interesting to me about this story and its impact during the Cold War was that almost all of us use the tools of this era every single day. So you have the highways that came about in part because of Eisenhower's fears about what would happen to urban areas during a nuclear war. Then, of course, the internet actually grew up out of the Pentagon's attempts to build a decentralized communications network that could help sustain and survive a nuclear war. And the first chat programs were actually built in the emergency preparedness bunkers to help coordinate stockpiles during an urban disaster during the 1970s. And then every time any of us book an airline ticket on Expedia or Orbitz, we're actually using technology that was first developed, the Sabre system, to track incoming Soviet bombers and give early warning systems time to activate. So even though none of the worst case scenarios happened, the legacy of this technology is something that we live with every day.
I want to talk a little bit about the Kennedy years, because this is maybe the closest we ever came to all-out nuclear war. The Cuban Missile Crisis, a lot of people of a certain age have watched, and I did, mostly laughed along with the film Dr. Strangelove. It's the Stanley Kubrick dark satire about a fail-safe system for nuclear deterrence that really goes horribly wrong. I assumed that much of that film was highly exaggerated, but you point out in the book that two real-life Kennedy administration advisors were the inspiration for two of the characters in that film. Tell us, who were Edward Teller and Herman Kahn?
So these were nuclear war strategists during the Kennedy years, and they really argued some of the most thoughtful, if that's an appropriate word for such a strange topic, nuclear war doctrine of the era. But I think more broadly, what, as you're saying, would surprise many listeners is understanding just how much of a movie like Dr. Strangelove was in fact true to life at the time. A lot of listeners who have seen that show will remember the phrase, we have to worry about the mineshaft gap. Right. Well, one of the odd things is actually the United States was for many years actively very worried about there being a mineshaft gap. And for the 1950s, the U.S. Government and actually they enlisted the Boy Scouts to help map the nation's caves and abandoned mines as possible fallout shelters and to begin to try to outfit and stock some of those abandoned mines and abandoned caves in states like Kentucky and Missouri and Alabama as actual fallout shelters, with the idea that hundreds, if not thousands, of people would be able to flock into these abandoned mines and live out the days of nuclear winter.
You know, it recalls that scene where they're down in the war room and they're starting to rationalize the loss of millions and millions of people's lives. And they're talking very rationally about it. And it does seem absurd. Again, Kubrick makes this a satire, but you have a footnote here in the book and you quote Teller and Kahn, who they say, well, when asked about what life in a shelter would be like, as you were describing, they dismiss the concern, saying, well, you're sipping a drink, munching on something tasteless, and it's dark and crowded. A Greenwich Village nightclub.
Exactly. And that for amazing. A while, there this idea that we would just live underground for some length of time was, in fact, very much widely accepted as part of this doomsday and nuclear war planning. And you saw cases out west, actually, where elementary schools were built entirely underground so that the school children would be better protected when nuclear war came. And government officials argued that, daylight, the problem is you have to be close to a window. But the beauty of this modern advanced fluorescent lighting technology was that there could be even light throughout an underground bunker facility where people were living.
Let's take a call now from Rutland City. Bob is on the line. Hi, Bob.
Yes, thank you. I was going to ask if your guest addressed in his book, talk about not being forthcoming by the government, some of what they euphemistically refer to as broken arrows, like, for example, in North Carolina in 61 when they dropped the 24-megaton bomb to, like, a swampy area, which they never could locate. So I just wonder if you addressed any of those issues. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. The Goldsboro incident, I believe you are referring to, which, as you said, was one of several incidents during those 1950s and 1960s where the U.S. military planes crashed and lost nuclear weapons. And there were a number of these incidents because part of this era was the Strategic Air Command, which was the Air Force unit that was in charge of our nuclear bombers. It kept an airborne alert where they kept planes in the air 24 hours a day flying these big loops armed with nuclear weapons. And the idea was to ensure that the U.S. would always have a retaliatory capability, that even if a surprise attack caught all of our forces on the ground, there would still be sets of these planes in the air ready to strike the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. And perhaps no surprise to anyone, one of the problems of keeping nuclear-armed bombers in the air 24 hours a day was that occasionally they crash, and that by the end of the 1960s, the decision had been made that so many of these planes had crashed, all of them just very narrowly averting nuclear catastrophe. The Goldsboro incident that the caller referenced, the accident actually tripped two of the three safety checks on one of those thermonuclear bombs. So it should not have gone off under any circumstances, but the accident was so violent that it in fact triggered two of the three triggers that would have actually set it off.
You know, in the book, there's a lot of attention paid to securing individual leaders, a listing of who are the critical people to save in the event of a nuclear war, whether these are elected people, cabinet officers, military leaders. At one point, a list of reporters was to be saved was made. I'm happy about that. What does that reveal, though, about what we consider essential to preserving the country functioning?
So this was a part of that whole conversation about, you know, if you're going to preserve America, what do you preserve? Yeah. And the challenge was each federal agency had its own post-nuclear attack responsibilities. And they were generally vaguely related to what that agency did during peacetime, but not necessarily. So the post office was actually the agency that was going to be in charge of registering the dead and figuring out who was still alive in the United States. And you would show up in refugee camps, and there would be these little postcard forms that you filled out with your name and which family members or friends were in your party, and you could mail them to other family members, and then the post office would try to figure out where those family members were and be able to help relocate everyone. The National Park Service was actually the agency that was going to run those refugee camps because the idea was that the national parks would be largely untouched by nuclear war. And so you would flee out into the wilderness, and there your friendly neighborhood park rangers would be waiting to take care of you in nuclear war. And each of these agencies, you know, had personnel who were designated to take over after an attack. And this sort of gets to this larger continuity of government question, which I think would surprise many people listening, which is, you know, we think of the president as the person that we elect every 4 years. But actually the presidency today, because of these Cold War plans and because of the way that nuclear weapons have reshaped the way that government operates, the presidency is actually an entity that involves several hundred people today. Mm. And so you have this line of succession for the president, which, you know, many people will understand about, you know, the vice president, Speaker of the House, the president pro tem of the Senate, and then each of the cabinet offices. Well, each of those cabinet offices also has its own line of succession. And so, you know, you have not just the 20 people in line for the presidency, you have 20 people in each of the lines for the cabinet as well. And so after an attack that wipes out Washington, you end up very quickly with this very strange scenario where you have people like the UN ambassador, the highest ranking State Department official outside of Washington, stepping up to become Secretary of State. You have the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, basically the top federal prosecutor for Chicago, becoming the Attorney General. And you can just sort of imagine the chaos and confusion after a catastrophic attack on Washington, where you have sort of all of these people nationwide who are popping up and saying, "Hi, I'm here to lead the country. You've never heard of me and may have never even heard of my office, but I'm now in charge."
Well, remember in the early 80s when Alexander Haig famously said, "I'm in charge now," after President Reagan was shot. And there was a lot of confusion then about, you know, who really was in charge of the country. He kind of made that bold statement.
And one of the strange things, and this is, part of the challenge of understanding these plans is that some level of them are just highly secret, and we don't really have great visibility into what they are. There are also, though, enormous problems with the plans that we do understand. So you mentioned that Al Haig moment, which is certainly one of the most famous moments of chaos in Washington. Well, it turns out, actually, Al Haig has a very strong legal argument that people don't understand, which is it is not at all clear from the Constitution that the president pro tem of the Senate or the Speaker of the House is constitutionally and legally allowed to step into the presidency. And no less an authority on the Constitution than James Madison argued that they could not. And so in a moment of chaos in Washington, you know, with the president and the vice president gone, you could very well see a Secretary of State challenging the Speaker of the House or the president pro tem of the Senate as to whether they were legally allowed to be stepping into the presidency. And you can sort of imagine being the young officer at the Pentagon answering the red telephone. And you have Rex Tillerson in one ear and Paul Ryan in the other, and both of them very legitimately possibly claiming to be president of the United States.
But what's remarkable about that, Garrett, is that people listening to that may be thinking, you know what? Who cares? I don't care if it's Rex Tillerson or Paul Ryan. Where am I going to get my food? You know, there's a nuclear fallout outside. Where do I go to get that duct tape? What do I do to get clean water? What about those plans? Are those plans included in any of this?
So, again, the government sort of thought through all of this in this very strange and very calculated way that when you read them on paper, sort of your first thought is, wow, these are incredibly detailed. And your second thought is, wow, none of these things would have actually worked. And so they did come up with these very careful food provisions. The U.S. Department of Agriculture built this special cracker, the survival biscuit, that was mass-produced by Nabisco, 160 million of them nationwide, and sort of distributed to fallout shelters nationwide. And then, of course, you know, they went through all of these different aspects of government. So the IRS sat down and figured out how they would assess taxes on nuclear damaged property after an attack. Because, of course, you know, taxes don't go away after a nuclear war.
Of course. We've got a call. Donnie is on the line from Chelsea. Hi, Donnie. You're on Vermont Edition with Garrett Graff.
Yeah, Mitch. With these background people, during Eisenhower's administration, there was Curtis LeMay, who was pretty much of a wingnut and a dangerous human being, and he was high within the ranks of Eisenhower's military. If the author has mentions Curtis or not, but he certainly was a McCarthyist. He was a Goldwater follower. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was when you mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis, I was a junior in high school. After that, the one thing that I really that has hit me throughout most of my life was Bob Dylan's Hard Rain, which was a take on what we would survive as, what a nuclear war would become, and very moving and very poignant. And that's pretty much it.
Donnie, thank you very much for the call. And I do know that Curtis LeMay figures prominently in your book, Eric.
Yeah, and we should have mentioned him as part of that conversation about Herman Kahn and Dr. Strangelove, because Curtis LeMay obviously is another one of the figures that was satirized during the Dr. Strangelove movie. But that Hard Rain, I mean, there is this very poignant and shocking story, again, talking about how nuclear weapons sort of reshaped the way that presidents thought about war and thought about this era, where during the early Kennedy years, the first year of the administration, the Soviet Union resumed atmospheric nuclear testing. And the U.S. very promptly resumed atmospheric nuclear testing. I mean, sort of blowing up nuclear bombs to test them. And there's a story that I tell in the book about Kennedy sitting at in the Oval Office on a day when there were no Russians in the Oval Office. And he's getting briefings on these nuclear tests. And someone is explaining to him the concept of fallout, which was very new at that time. People were still very much trying to understand it. And he says, wait, so there's this nuclear fallout coming back down in the rain outside right now. And the aides say, you know, yes, Mr. President, the rain right outside right now has nuclear fallout in it. And he just goes to the window and just stands there watching the rain fall on the South Lawn of the White House. And it just sort of falls very quiet in the Oval Office as this realization comes upon him.
It's really a chilling image. What do we take away from Raven Rock? I mean, you wrote this book because you mentioned in the introduction that you wanted this to be a book about how these decisions were made. What is it that people should take away? Because we're going to come back from a break and talk about things that are going on right now. Why did you want to write this book?
So for one thing, it's a fascinating story of how nuclear war has changed our modern world, even though it has never happened. You know, these plans are still very secret today. All of these plans are still in operation today, and they have been updated to reflect modern threats. So the post office isn't in charge of registering the dead in the event of a nuclear war anymore. The post office, though, is the agency in charge of distributing medical countermeasures in the event of a public health pandemic or a chemical or biological attack. So, you know, the post office, your friendly neighborhood postman or postwoman would be the person showing up at your door today with an Ebola vaccine or some sort of chemical weapon antidote, which is something you might want to consider the next time you're thinking about whether to give a holiday tip to the postman or postwoman.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm, and my guest is our Vermont-based journalist Garrett Graff, talking about his book Raven Rock and also a lot of extensive reporting that he's done on security issues. We're going to get into some of that right now. Garrett Graff, the Washington Post and the New York Times reported this week that President Trump essentially bragged about classified foreign intelligence to the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador during a meeting at the Oval Office last week. Now, this story goes in a lot of different directions. You coincidentally reported on and researched on a lot of this, so let's break it down a bit. First, the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. Who is he? What is his sphere of influence in Washington?
Sergei Kislyak is, of course, a figure at the center of many of these conspiracy theories around Donald Trump and whatever his ties to Russia may be. He's been present at many of these suspicious seeming meetings with Jeff Sessions. He was sitting in the front row of Donald Trump's first foreign policy speech last year at the Mayflower Hotel. He met with Trump officials at Trump Tower during the transition and even brought the head of the Russia's Development Bank, which is a known spying entity, into Trump Tower to meet with Jared Kushner during the transition. And of course, Sergei Kislyak's telephone calls with Michael Flynn are the central thread of the incident that led to
him
Michael Flynn's firing or his resignation in the early days of the Trump administration as national security advisor. Now, I just have, as you alluded to, a new profile of Sergei Kislyak that I wrote for Esquire magazine. And he is this fascinating character, in part because this idea that he is some sort of modern-day Rasputin connecting the all levels of the nine-dimensional chess conspiracy that is Donald Trump and Russia is really surprising and almost laughable to those who actually know Kislyak well. Kislyak is one of the most accomplished diplomats of his generation and has risen steadily through the ranks of the Russian foreign ministry. And actually, since 1980, has spent more of his life living in the United States than he has in Russia, as in a rotating set of positions at the UN in New York and at the embassy here in Washington. And so this idea that sort of all of a sudden today, no one can remember ever hearing or meeting Sergei Kislyak is of deep amusement to those in the U.S. who have actually worked alongside him for almost 40 years.
Should people be troubled, though, that Michael Flynn was in contact with him? Was he also the person that Jeff Sessions turns out to have contacted when he told Congress he had not spoken with anyone in Russia?
Yeah, and so part of this is the nature of the interactions rather than that they happened at all. You know, in almost any event, you would want as a country for your ambassador to be in contact with high-level officials on Capitol Hill or high-level party officials in the United States or high-level campaign officials in a presidential election. What's strange, though, and suspicious about these meetings is both the extent to which Trump administration officials or Trump campaign officials have misled or ignored or lied about, to the extent that we can say that someone lied about something, these interactions. And then, moreover, what we think we know transpired during them. So it's Sally Yates, the former deputy attorney general, former acting attorney general fired by President Trump in the first weeks of his administration, her warning to the White House that Michael Flynn had been compromised during these calls with Sergei Kislyak, in particularly in the way that he had reported them to people like Vice President Pence, is what is troubling to people. And then those Jeff Sessions interactions, part of what's strange about them, I spoke to Andrei Kozarev, who actually was Sergei Kislyak's boss during the 1990s in the Russian Foreign Ministry. Andrei Kozarev was the Russian Foreign Minister during the 1990s. And he says it's not to him strange that Jeff Sessions met with Sergei Kislyak. It's that Jeff Sessions didn't say during that meeting or didn't appear to say, or we don't know that he said, hey, Russia, don't meddle in our elections. And that he didn't confront Kislyak at that time when we knew at that point there were already hints publicly and certainly to a high-level official like Jeff Sessions that Russia was taking active measures against the U.S. election.
Of course, the big news that's breaking as we're talking is that Washington Post article saying that President Trump shared classified information that a U.S. ally had given to U.S. intelligence. And that by revealing this info, at the very least, U.S. allies are far less likely to share valuable information with the U.S. government in the future. Now, the White House is denying the account, as the Post reported it. President Trump, as he is fond of doing, has gone to Twitter to say that he had every right to give information to the Russians. What are we talking about here as far as what may have been done in a compromising fashion? I mean, is this a big deal, to put it bluntly?
This is a tremendously huge deal. I mean, there's no other way to look at it. I've reported on national security and intelligence for almost a dozen years now, and this is, frankly, a truly stunning story. There are several layers of weirdness, again, to sort of unpack from this one incident. I mean, first, remember this meeting last Wednesday was the only thing on Donald Trump's public schedule the day after he fired FBI Director Jim Comey for what his administration now admits was effectively unhappiness at the way that Jim Comey was pursuing the investigation of the Trump campaign into its links to and possible collusion with Russia. Now, in that meeting last Wednesday, we had no idea that Sergei Kislyak was even involved in it. He was not on the list of guests that the White House released. The only way that we actually know that Sergei Kislyak was involved in that meeting was because he was in the photographs that the Russian propaganda arm released of President Trump and Sergei Kislyak.
Because the U.S. media was not allowed into that meeting.
And the only photos that we have, the photos that are running on the front pages of most newspapers in the United States today, we only get because of they were released by Russian propaganda outlets.
I got to get to Jim Comey quickly. I wish we're running out of time here, but and this was just a week ago. It's amazing how fast this stuff is moving. But You wrote a fascinating piece on Jim Comey and about the firing that Donald Trump did. The timing of it, as you have just alluded to, looks terrible, as they call the optics for this look bad. However, you do point out in your article that as far as Trump saying that James Comey was a bit of a showboat, liked to be in the forefront too much, you kind of agree with that. What was James Comey doing that you feel was not really correct for the role of an FBI director?
So there are two very different issues stemming out of last week's firing of Jim Comey. The first was there is, in fact, a very good argument to be made that Jim Comey had compromised the integrity and the reputation of the FBI with his actions over the last year. He was, as I say in the article, becoming increasingly politically isolated in Washington. He has made his career being oppositional to power and sort of, as I say somewhat pejoratively, biting the hand that feeds him over the course of his career. Now, that independent streak has in many ways struck him very well. But over the last year, it has become a real political liability for him, and particularly his actions around the Hillary Clinton email investigation had really managed to anger both sides. Separate from that, though, is this question of whether the President of the United States should be removing an FBI director in the center of an investigation that FBI director is leading into the president's administration. That's where it sort of gets dicey. I mean, you could very much see a scenario where Barack Obama could have fired Jim Comey after the election last year. You could see a scenario this spring where Hillary Clinton, had she won the election, could make a good argument about firing Jim Comey. And there is very much, I think, a sense that the FBI needs to move beyond Jim Comey in order to restore its nonpartisan, nonpolitical nature. At the same time, though, boy, as you say, the idea of firing him in the midst of this investigation while almost explicitly admitting after the fact that you fired him because of the investigation is terrible for this president.
I read an interesting article in The Atlantic saying that these calls for a special counsel to investigate this would actually might be counterproductive because they would be focused on only a criminal investigation of this. They couldn't look at broader issues that may crop up here. Is a special counsel, a special investigator, the answer to this, or can a new FBI director and a new FBI team look into this the way that it perhaps should be looked into?
As best we can tell, and obviously we don't know that much about the level of detail that is taking place in this FBI investigation, but there are likely at least three different FBI investigations that are unfolding right now. Likely one that is based in Pittsburgh, which is where the FBI's key cyber resources are, that is focused on the hacking of the DNC and the hacking of John Podesta's email and the Russian active measures there. Second is a Russian counterintelligence investigation, sort of an espionage investigation about the Trump campaign's relationships with the administration that appears to be being run out of the Eastern District of Virginia. Separate from both of those, though, are questions about Michael Flynn and his ties and with Sergei Kislyak, as we've discussed, or other Russian officials. And perhaps even separate from that are questions about Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort and his own relationships in this area.
One word answer, Garrett Graff, do you think there's more going to come out of this?
I think there'll be more coming out about this today alone.
Today alone. Garrett Graff, thank you so much for being with us this hour. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Go to vpr.net/Vermont Edition to learn more about Graff's extensive reporting on the security issues we've been discussing and also his new book, Raven Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. And again, we'd like to disclose that Garrett Graff is a member of the VPR Board of Directors.